Anatomy of a Worldview, Part 1. The first talk in a series on foundations of knowing the truth was presented by R. Wesley Hurd on October 1, 1991, at McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2013. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side. The following recording was made in a classroom setting, and some of the students' questions were inaudible. It is hoped that Dr. Hurd's answers will be sufficient to understand the context.
The subject that we're going to discuss for the next 50 minutes is what I've entitled The Anatomy of a Worldview. And this will be session one. There'll be two more in addition to this. Well, I've handed you an outline that I'm going to work off of tonight, and I'll be giving you one each week. And I'd like to just sort of jump right in. I'm going to make the assertion that God has created us to be significant. Now, that sounds maybe not terribly surprising. That's maybe not a new thought for you. But I'd like to argue the case, and I think the whole foundation of the worldview program that we're in wants to argue a kind of general perspective on what it means to be human. It's sort of like coming at the Christian faith, or what it means to be a Christian, from what I think most people would consider to be a fresh perspective. Because we're not asking the question in particularly religious terms. We're just asking the plain generic question, what does it mean to be a human being? Now, as Christians, we assume, not without looking and thinking about it, but we assume that the Bible is going to give us some answers to that question. And we have to do our homework to figure out what the array of answers that would be in response to the question, what does it mean to be human? But nevertheless, we expect that the Bible is going to give us those answers. However, I would argue that even if I were not a Christian, and putting it a little differently, I would argue that most people have a very intense internal struggle over the issue of what does it mean to be human, and more specifically, focusing right on them, asking themselves the question or trying to answer the question, I desire to be significant, I want to be worth something, I think I am worth something, but how do I know that? How would I prove that to myself as a human being? This is a particularly haunting question at the end of the 20th century. And perhaps a little bit in the next session we'll get into sort of the spirit of the age in which we live. God has created us to be significant. And therefore, I believe he has hardwired us, is the word I used, hardwired us to both to need or require and to seek significance, meaning and fulfilling experiences, or meaningful and fulfilling experiences. Let's start at the most basic level. Let's just start with raw survival. We awaken in this world, our consciousness about ourselves grows imperceptibly to us, but at a certain point in our young lives, we are awakened. At a certain point in our young life, we're aware that we're aware of ourselves. We've arrived, we're here, we're somewhere, we are something, we are somebody. And we immediately begin the process, even as an infant fresh out of the womb, to interact with our environment in such a way that we have to survive. I mean, we have to get food, we have to breathe, we have to stay warm. There are certain kinds of physical demands. And what I'm going to argue is that at a very mundane level, our worldview functions, has those kinds of functions in it, especially as we grow more sophisticated in our perceptions and in our interpretations of life. Not only do we need to survive physically, but we need to survive psychologically, emotionally. I think at the end of the 20th century, as we are now, there is an incredible, incredible pressure, tension in all of our lives, especially in the West, in particular, those who have inherited the dominant ideas and beliefs of the West, which is now a non-Christian and largely unreligious dominating culture, where there, we've lost our connectedness to community, we've lost our connectedness to family, we've lost our connectedness to being located in one place for a long time. And all of these things cast weight on me to define myself. Whereas in the past, in the historical past, a lot of times who I am was attached to my family, to my traditions, to my tribe, my town, if I was raised in a town. All those things have been pretty well destroyed by modernity and technology. And now we are subjects desperately needing to understand who we are in a society that's telling us there really aren't any definitions. Just decide for yourself who you are. It puts incredible pressure on us. And our worldview, the way we look at our life and ourselves, has a great deal to do with how we define and determine who we are, who I am. As we pursue these needs, and because we are equipped with intelligence, we each construct a view of reality, a worldview, which serves as an interpretive map for sorting out our life experiences. If we're Christian, our worldview holds serious moral implications and power in our lives. Now, this will become more clear as I unpack what we're going to talk about tonight, where we actually outline what is a worldview. But I would argue that the Bible makes it very clear that a person's view of life, their vision of life, their vision of reality, their interpretation, their understanding of who they are as creatures, whether they believe there is an infinite personal moral being, a creator God above all, has a great deal to do with how we live out our lives and whether or not we believe that there is such a thing as evil. Is evil real? Is there anything substantially different between the things that we call evil and the things that we call good, or the gradations between the two? A worldview, the way we look at reality, is going to interpret those, going to tell us those things. So all of that is to say that a worldview is very integral to what it means to be a human being. I believe the Bible tells us that we all have worldviews, whether we are aware of them or not. I believe that the Bible tells us clearly that we are rational, intelligent beings created in some way in the image of the Creator. I think people, a lot of theologians and even historically people have questioned or wondered what the first chapter of Genesis means when it says that we are made in the image of God. But as best I can tell at this point, I think it includes, at least it includes, rationality and intelligence as God is intelligent and rational. That is to say, God's mind, though it be in a sense infinitely greater than ours, functions, there's a coherence between the way our minds work and the way God's mind works. There's a fit between the two, and we'll talk some more about that later. But I think this is implied in John, the opening verse of John, where I think the Apostle John selects, he looks around and he's full of this message that he wants to speak to the Gentiles in a very Hellenistic world around him. And he selects a concept that he knew would be commonly understood to the Hellenist mind. The concept was the Logos, the Word. In the beginning was the Word. In the beginning was the Logos. And I think the kind of picture that John is painting there is, if you can imagine with me 20 centuries ago and walking out into a starry, starry night in the Mediterranean and looking up and seeing the sky painted with this array of stars and as we all have experienced reflecting on the incredible grandeur of what you see, but also the incredible order, the incredible coherence, the incredible beauty that exists there as well. And in the Greek mind and in that Hellenistic culture, there was an understanding that Logos referred to the rational, purposive infrastructure, if you want to put that term to it, the structure of what is real. What's behind what's real? What makes what's real understandable? What is the creative force behind everything that is real? And the Greek would have said logos. And I think what the Greek mind was suggesting was that I intuitively sense, and in my guts up, so to speak, I sense that this is a world that has been created, that it's rational, that it has meaning, that it's purposeful. And in a sense, the Greek was saying that was sort of the equivalent of a God concept. And John is taking that term and saying, in the beginning, you're right, in the beginning was logos. And then in the 14th verse he says, and this logos became flesh and walked among us. Mind-blowing concept. But that's where he starts his gospel message about Christ. He wants to find some common turf, and then he wants to build off of that idea. And so he lands on that. The implications of all that I just took too much time to talk about, I believe, is the implications are that the creation, everything that exists, including we human beings, the Bible explains to us as being the, in terms of creatures, we are the pinnacle of God's creation on this earth, in that we bear His image. That we are created in a logos kind of way. That is, we have intelligence. We are made by intelligence, and there is a coherence between what's out there and who we are and how we think. We'll unpack that some more a little bit later, and I think Charlie will be spending quite a bit of time on that issue. What we're going to do in this little mini course is define what a worldview is, explain how worldviews are constructed, how do they get into us, how do we acquire one, explain how a worldview works, how it functions, and then argue some reasons for the importance of understanding on our part and understanding it. Why would it be useful or important to even have a kind of conceptual understanding of what a worldview is? Is it a practical thing? And I would argue very, very practical. So if you can get a little bit of a handle on what a worldview is and how it functions, it can be an extremely useful tool, if you want to put it in those terms, conceptual tool for understanding yourself and how you think and how you acquire knowledge and how others think. I remember reflecting in the first few years that we were here at the study center on the fact that after seeing several freshman classes come into the university and watching what happens when they hit a very secular university situation, if they came from a Christian home, which that's the kind of student I was thinking about here, it's as if everything that they had gotten from a good Christian family, from a church background, from, you know, years of Sunday school and listening to sermons in church and all that kind of stuff, maybe, let's say that this person comes to the university as a freshman and they've got a worldview. Let's call the worldview these glasses here, this set of lenses. And they're viewing their world through these lenses, and their world, at the point that they are in, say, in high school, family, friends, church, homework, sports, girlfriend, boyfriend. I mean, traditionally we understand that to be not a narrow world, but certainly a narrower world than when you make the next big step, which is either to the university or college or out into the working world or whatever. It's a fairly defined world. And let's assume that this person has learned their Christianity in that context. That's the only place they're going to learn it, for the most part, is somewhere in this context of family, friends, and church. And let's say that their Christianity has been taught to them in such a way that it does explain friends, school, homework, sports. You know, it makes sense of their world, but their world at that point is relatively simple. Well, the worldview, which is at least partially Christian at this point, is it interpreting their world as best it can. And for the most part, functioning fairly well for most high school students who have a reasonable Christian worldview. They might not even understand it that way, but that's the term we're applying to it. But let's say they get to the university and then once in 1 year, the exposure to ideas, to the history of ideas, to beliefs, is going to just be blown sideways in terms of philosophy, sociology, literature, study of religion, da 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 da. You could just go on and on and on, making a list of subjects that all of a sudden their world is going to be, I shouldn't go this way, I should go exploded this way. And if we take their worldview graphically and impose it on this world, up to this point, their worldview has been able to explain pretty much a small world in personal terms. Personal friends, school, family, church, the world in those terms. But suddenly now they're going to have to start explaining these things. And the question is, does one's faith, does one's worldview, if it is attempting to be biblical or Christian, is it capable, does it have the kind of conceptual ability to explain or begin to explain these things? And in most cases, it doesn't. In the vast majority of cases, it doesn't. And in some respects, we wouldn't expect it to, because the level of sophisticated information being passed to the student and the level of bias being passed to the student, the bias against religion in general and Christianity in particular, is thick in a major university. So this sets up a real tension, because pretty soon, if they cannot connect Christianity, some understanding of their faith, to what they're trying to understand in terms of social theories, again, philosophy, literature, ideas, the world of ideas being thrown at them, this sets up a tension. So that on the one hand, I have my faith as a student, and on the other hand, I have all these things that are getting bigger and bigger and heavier, and I can't seem to put the two together. And this causes either severe schizophrenia, because I live this Christian world over here, and then I go to university, I don't know how in the world to fit my faith into this over here. And they just live in two worlds for 4, 5, 6 years. Or, in some cases, the people who are the most honest will basically, at least for a time, bag the faith, because their faith doesn't seem to have the kind of explanatory power necessary to cope with the kinds of questions that are being thrown at it. And again, because of the biases and things that are just thick in the university and a lot of other dynamics at work, it's very, very easy to feel that pressure. So worldviews are very, very important. Let's start with some definitions here and a little overview. Every person has a worldview. A worldview is a collection of beliefs and assumptions a person uses about who they are and how the world works. A sort of working map of, and I put in quotes here, the way things are and ought to be. In other words, a large part of our worldview can be very taken for granted. We don't even know we have these beliefs. One of the most immediate ways to find out what you believe and you didn't know it is to go to the different culture and find out how many things stick out that you assumed that were true in your middle-class American experience, that's where you came from, and what is believed and felt about even the most mundane of things. Like for me, for example, when I lived in England for a couple of years, one thing I had a very difficult time getting used to is small refrigerators. I mean, you think of that as being nothing. I mean, that's so insignificant. But I literally, there was a shock, an internal shock in me when I saw the refrigerator, and I thought it was some kind of cabinet or something. I mean, it was just this little thing, but this big. And that was the way they're, you know, most people at that time, back in the early 70s, that was fairly standard. But there was a belief about, see, this exposed a belief in me that all refrigerators are big. And all refrigerators, to be legitimate refrigerators, had to be this big. And that wasn't true. But it was a belief that I had embedded in my worldview, absorbed from my culture, and it was exposed to me when I was in a different situation. At the most mundane level, human beings use this conceptual belief map to survive in the physical world. We believe that red lights mean stop, and we believe that green lights mean go. And if our worldview says something else, we may be in trouble. And we're talking physical world here. We don't eat things that we know are not going to do us... We don't eat things... Well, we eat bad things all the time, but we don't eat things that we know are outrageously bad for us. Poison, something that's going to make us sick. Physical level. At a more sophisticated level, they use it to interpret or make sense of all their life experiences so that they can survive psychologically as well. So a worldview functions kind of like a filing system. It's like everybody's got a file drawer, and you all have files in it with tabs on it. You've got a tab for any category. What does it mean to be human? You've got a tab, a file, and you've got some stuff in it. But so everybody's got the tabs, or at least for the most part, all the same tabs, but everybody also may have radically different information in those files about what they believe. Or it's a set of lenses through which we view the world. It's something that we use to interpret. It's a grid that we use to interpret our world. Worldviews are built into human beings because we have needs to, and I just listed a few things here, unify thought and experience, define good, find meaning, find hope, guide our thinking, guide our activity, or our actions. Worldviews do all those things for us. Here's a little bit more sophisticated definition taken from James Altice, and I'll just read through this and you can follow along. A worldview or a vision of life is a framework or a set of fundamental beliefs through which we view the world and our calling and future in it. This vision may be so internalized that it goes largely unquestioned. It may be greatly refined through cultural historical development. It may not be explicitly developed into a systematic conception of life. It may not be theoretically deepened into a philosophy. It may not even be codified into creedal form. Nevertheless, this vision is a channel for the ultimate beliefs which give direction and meaning to life. It is integrative and interpretive framework by which order and disorder are judged. The standard by which reality is managed and pursued. It is the set of hinges on which all our everyday thinking and doing turns. Although a vision of life or a worldview is held only by individuals, it is communal in scope and structure. Since a worldview gives the terms of reference by which the world and our place in it can be structured and illumined, a worldview binds its adherents together into community, or at least it has that potential. The last page in your little outline, there's a sort of a funny little map like this. This is my attempt to put some things together into a little graphic. You can see that I've given it three components of making up the totality of the components of a worldview. I've also called it the Christian mind on this sheet. First of all, there's the heart. The Bible tells us very clearly that there is this seat or core of our lives, that the Bible often uses the word the heart for. I think it's also fair to call it the mind in certain cases, that's an interchangeable kind of concept. But it's also described as the place out of which come decisions and choices, and that they are moral in nature. That is, God judges what comes from the heart, or the state or condition of the heart, or the posture of the heart toward God and toward man and toward life as good or evil. In other words, it's the moral core or center of our being. And I think the biblical pattern is that the Bible suggests that it's out of this moral core of our lives that we make choices. And it's from there that we choose, in the next little box there, beliefs, assumptions, or presuppositions. Now, it's in that box that our basic worldview beliefs go. That is, what you believe about God, man, and reality, and the universe go in that box. I'm going to unpack this more specifically next week, but I just wanted to point this out tonight and kind of show you how I see these relating to each other, what I think the Bible would explain the relationship is. In that box, we would stack of beliefs. That's where the files would go on what I believe about any particular subject. The next box up, I've included simply to point out that there is this built-in intelligence. There is a mechanism of intelligence in us. It's the gift of being able to think. It's the gift of being able to realize the difference between A and non-A. The mechanisms of rationality. So, what have we got going?
With logic coming into play there.
Yeah. It's basic. It's the basic ability to be logical or to do logic. And I'm calling that the mechanism of intelligence because that's what allows us to differentiate between one thing and another. Now what I've done is I've drawn some arrows here that sort of interconnect all these things. And what I wanted to show by the flow of these arrows is, and it's sort of circular, you can see, what I meant to diagrammatically describe here is that I think that when Jesus said that it's out of the heart of a person that if a person is defiled, it's the person is defiled not by what goes in, but by what is coming out of his heart. In other words, he was making a statement about the moral condition of fallen human beings, the moral condition of those caught in death and sin, trapped in moral corruption, trapped in a state where we are not able to be good as God is good. So the condition of our heart, as the Bible describes it, is that we're not going to choose, ultimately, we're not going to choose good. We're going to rather to run from it. The Bible describes this as rebels. So the beliefs and assumptions and presuppositions that we choose will be colored by our tendency to want to protect ourselves, to be our own God, the decider of our own destiny, the controller of our own future, irrespective of whether God is there or whether God wants anything to do with us or not, from our perspective. And that process of coming to those beliefs, adding to those beliefs, deleting beliefs, shifting and refining those beliefs is all made possible by the mechanisms of our intelligence. But because this whole process is controlled by the heart, the conclusions that we come to wrap right back around and justify the condition of my heart. So you see the circularity. Because I'm a sinner, because I tend to want to define myself on my own terms, to choose what is good for me, irrespective of whether the God of the Bible is telling me something different or not, that tendency in me is going to sustain itself and justify itself and fix into my worldview those things which allow my heart to be comfortable before myself and certainly before a God from whom I am hiding and running. Okay, I think that's basically all I wanted to do was show you that, and I'll probably refer to that next week. All right, now in closing, the last few minutes that we have tonight, what I'd like to do is refer to a set of questions which I'm going to describe as, or define as, a set of basic worldview questions. These questions come out of a book called The Universe Next Door by James Sire, and I've listed that in the outline. This book is still available, and it can be ordered, and I believe it's well worth, if you're interested in the subject, it's probably, well, undoubtedly, it's the most practically written and most helpful text or book that I've ever come across on getting a person familiar with the idea of worldviews, how they work, and then giving you a sort of a very readable and understandable survey of the dominant worldviews that are out there in the world today, from Western rationalism and secularism to descriptions of what preceded this dominant worldview in the West, which was deism, and before that, classical Christendom. After this, we're moving toward, well, he describes existentialism and nihilism and Eastern monism, Eastern pantheism, and the New Age worldview. And it's a very, very helpful book. If you're interested in it, it's well worth adding to your library. Anyway, these questions come from his book. I've chosen them to use them because I think it's a really helpful book to use, and I think these are very useful questions at getting at the basic idea of a worldview. All right? Any basic worldview is going to attempt to answer all these questions. Any coherent worldview that is claiming to be a full-blown view of reality and the world and what it means to be human is going to answer these questions. What are they? What is prime reality? What is external reality? Now, later, next week, I'm going to collapse those into one question. Basically, what is real? What is the nature of reality? And I'll talk about that just for a couple minutes before we quit tonight. Third question, who or what is man? What does it mean to be human? I'm using that term man in the generic sense. Four, what is history's purpose? Where is history going somewhere? Does it have meaning? Five, how do we determine good and evil? Or what is the basis of morality and ethics? Upon what foundation would we build our conclusions about what is right and what is wrong? Are they universal? If so, how would we decide? Sixth, what is death. How do we answer the question of death and its meaning or its significance? Is it significant? Is there anything after death? And seven, how do we know? How do we know anything with any kind of certainty? Is certainty of knowledge something we must have? What degree of certainty do we need to have? Is there any way to prove without any doubt what I know? Those are the questions of epistemology. So these are the seven questions that any basic worldview is going to attempt to answer. It's going to attempt to put them in one kind of coherent picture. Tonight, just for starters, let's try to answer the questions regarding how would we answer these questions with regard to Christianity as a worldview. If we say that the Bible has a worldview, what answers would the Bible give to these questions? Now, what is prime reality? And what would you say the Bible's response to that is? You say, what do you mean by prime reality?
Yeah.
I think what we're getting at here is, what is the most essential reality, perhaps that reality out of which every other reality springs? What reality is the base of reality? And how would the Bible answer that question?
I don't know, I'm still trying to figure this out, but I think that reality would have something to do with true life that only God gives us.
Right.
And anything outside that true life, that one real life, was the external reality.
Okay, I think this is maybe a little unfair to kind of just throw this out cold turkey, but we're looking at a really basic response here.
I say the most basic truth is that God is who he said he is.
Okay.
That God is.
Yeah. I think that's what we're after here. Prime reality is the reality upon which every other reality depends. It's just God is there. Now you weren't far off, but that's the basic answer to this question from out of the Bible. All right, then what the heck are we talking about when we say external reality?
Some creational positions that arise out of the idea that God is.
Some of the
ideas that would naturally arise out of the idea that God is.
Or not just ideas, but maybe even physical reality. Creation, I think you said creation. I think that's what we're talking about here. The Bible would make a distinction about reality as being in two parts. Reality is the God who is there, the Creator, and external reality is the creation that God created. The Bible makes a distinction between the God who is there, infinite, personal, and God's creation, which is something external from God. Now, where this becomes an issue is if you look at the other major contending worldview today, which is Eastern religion or Eastern pantheism, or we could use the word Eastern monism. Because Eastern religion, like Hinduism, would answer this question, the difference between prime reality and external reality is zero. Prime reality is the title for God is that God is the same as everything that exists. They are the same. They are coterminous. There is no distinction between God in the Eastern view and creation or us or the table or the chair or the tree or the soil or the earth. We're all a part of God, and in effect, we are an illusory part of God. We are a shifting, illusory reality within God, all part of God. Whereas the biblical worldview suggests that there is a great distinction between the Creator and the creation. So questions 1 and 2 come to bear primarily on that distinction.
Earlier when we were reading through these, you said that those are the seven questions that all worldviews strive to answer, that people need to answer with their worldviews. Why would 1 and 2 be separate? I'm just thinking, why wouldn't someone else say, someone with a different worldview than a Christian worldview, say that there are six questions that a worldview should answer, and the first one is, reality
is two parts, or one part, or whatever.
And that it makes no difference whether the Creator is separate from the creation or not. Mm-hmm. That's a matter of snare.
They could say that, and they could believe that. I'm sure there are people out there that do. I'm just suggesting that this set of questions from my own personal looking at the issues, does a pretty good job of capturing the major issues. It certainly doesn't cover everything. But on the other hand, well, I guess what I'd say is that this set of questions gives us a sort of concentrated, working, usable set of questions that you could read a magazine article or a book, and you could take these questions, and as you're reading the book or the article, whatever, you could ask yourself these questions. What does the author believe about these questions? And would help you sort of do this dissection or try to come to determine what's the author's worldview behind what they wrote. In other words, what are they presupposing? What do they believe that they're not necessarily making explicit in the writing? That kind of thing. But you're right. I mean, you could come up with any set of questions that you wanted to, or certainly a different set of questions, and make that work.
Do these two questions, correct me if I'm wrong, but do they set the basis for sin? If I say Hinduism, I don't know much about Hinduism, but they have one, and they believe that they're all one in God.
Well, it would come out by asking these questions that the issue of the definition of sin would hit probably on two points. First of all, in question number three, who or what is mankind? In describing the nature of man, you would say he or she is perfectible, or they are good, or they are not good, or you would come to some kind of conclusion about the nature, the basic character of this creature, this being. And also it would come to bear in the question of good and evil. I mean, if we're going to discuss the nature of man, does the question good or evil apply? Yes, it does. So it would come out as you ask the questions, but it would sort of flow back and forth between two questions. That's why, I mean, there's a certain, I think maybe this is what you're kind of getting to, there's a certain kind of, it looks like a sort of arbitrariness in coming up with these particular questions. But I think you'll see, especially if you read his book, you would see how he's constructed them, how he came up with them, and how useful they are. So going on quickly, because we need to close here, deciding the question, who or what is man, mankind? The Bible suggests man is a creature of God, made in God's image, created to be, in a sense, God's representative in the world, a very special role, very significant being, a very noble creature. And then it would go on to describe our fallenness and our brokenness. What is history? Just to compare again, history from a Christian worldview is linear. It's going somewhere. History in the Hindu, again, to take the Hindu or pantheistic worldview, is cyclical. History is repeating itself. It's just in a flux and flow, repeating itself. How do we determine good and evil? The Bible suggests that we determine good and evil on the basis of God's moral character. God has told us what kind of God he is and what kind of righteousness he desires for creation, and that forms the foundation for good and evil. In Eastern thought, good and evil are sort of flip sides of the same coin. There's a sense in which they don't exist. There's a sense in which if they do exist, they don't in the end make a great distinction between the two. Cruelty and non-cruelty end up being sort of non-distinguishable. What is death? And how do we know? Those questions, again, are just samples of responses to which the Bible would give. And when we got through answering those questions at some level, whether it be in depth or in brief, we would have kind of a working view of where a particular person was coming from, whether they, depending on how they answered those questions. Now, next week, I'm going to expand on this. I'm going to work from this grid, but I'm also going to add another layer so that we get a little bigger picture of how a worldview works and what it is. So thanks.